Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Besides its growth plans, what else should we be looking at when assessing Malaysia's largest IPO in 3 years? Morgan Stanley sees Palantir surging 31%. What's behind expectations for its fast profit growth? And it was all the buzz yesterday. DBS looking at a cryptocurrency exchange. Hasn't been confirmed yet. But what would this mean? Does this legitimize crypto in any way? Or is this more about institutional payments? And does this in any way mirror PayPal's foray into cryptocurrency in terms of widening Bitcoin's usage? We put those questions to Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. Good morning, Arun.
Good morning, Michelle. How are you?
I am doing really well. Glad you're here as always. So I don't know if you've heard, but Lucy Peng, she's emerging as one of the wealthiest people in the world. She's co-founder of Alibaba, and she's set to get a lot richer on that Ant IPO. You want to hazard a guess how much richer?
I believe something like $4 or $5 billion.
Why is it? You know everything. He knows everything. It's $5 billion, spot on. So I guess the question for Singapore investors is, are there instruments that one can use to get in on Ant Group's historic Shanghai, Hong Kong dual listing?
Oh, absolutely. So, other than being able to access the share directly through any kind of discount brokerage, be it like DBS Vickers, Saxo, Interactive Brokers, etc., you can also get access to the shares through ETFs. Mm-hmm. So most retail investors who do not spend enough time and effort trying to analyze an individual company, ETFs or exchange-traded funds are the best way to get access to a larger group of companies in that sector. So, if someone has obviously heard about the Ant Financial IPO, and that's, all kudos to the company founders, and not just Miss Lucy, but apparently I think there are like 6 or 7 other women billionaires that will be created because of this IPO.
Fantastic.
So that's amazing, right? Truly fantastic to see a country like China, which apparently is all against capitalism, according to most of Western media. It's coming out to be truly completely the opposite. But anyway, coming back to the whole exchange-traded fund concept, where retail investors can get access to, one of the main ones I would say is Renaissance Capital. The ticker is IPOS, that provides or enables investors to get access to a broad range of companies that are soon to be IPOing or that have just IPO'd. And that's great because, a lot of really good companies, and there's a lot of garbage, sadly, also in this field. Wow. But given the size of the Ant Financial IPO, once it actually becomes public, there will be a slight delay. But I'm sure it will take up a reasonably substantial portion of that ETF. Crane Shares is another ETF provider that provides the same kind of exposure. And, of course, you have a number of, broader emerging market ETFs or even China-specific ETFs like IEMG, VWO, where if investors have a broader view that, Ant Financial is just the peak, there's a whole swath of other Chinese-based companies which they would like to have exposure to, they can go for more of some of these more broader themed ETF names.
Okay, so help me understand, for the retail investor, if I want to part of the world's largest IPO Ant, I could go the ETF route, or I could wait and buy on the open market after trading starts?
That is correct. So typically for the first couple of hours, it's mostly, even though it's IPO'd, there usually is a big share pop. So sadly, retail investors will not be able to get access to that pre-market kind of trading. That's where the institutional market makers, institutional players, as well as investment banks who are the market makers for the stock, they kind of sort out where the initial tradable price would be of this share. So after a couple of hours, typically, that's when it's more freely tradable in the market. And that is when retail investors can get access to that share immediately, typically on the day off. ETFs is something to note where it does take some time which could range from a day to a couple of days to a week before that specific stock ticker is actually implemented into that IP, into that ETF ticker. So, you know, just something to be very careful about, where if a retail investor thinks that, oh, I bought Renaissance Capital IPOS ETF, and I still don't see 20% of that ETF having bought Ant IPO shares.
That's a great point. That's a very important point. All right. Speaking of IPO, it's IPO fever. I was looking at Malaysia's market, and Mr. DIY, which is part of the Mr. DIY group, its market cap has gone up to estimated some 10 billion Malaysian ringgit based on its initial public offer price of $1.60 Malaysian ringgit cents per share. So apparently now Mr. DIY is more valuable than Malaysia's airport operator and its national postal service provider. Imagine that. So what would an investor have to be looking at when assessing this IPO besides its growth plans?
You know, like I've seen the store myself. They've expanded into Singapore, Indonesia, Philippines, and it's a phenomenal story, right? This was a company that was founded in, I think it was 2005, and they managed to grow all the way up to like 600 stores across the region, all self-managed, which is a phenomenal testament that, you know, of the growth story of the ASEAN region. You don't need to be in the US or Europe, or now for that matter in China, to be able to create like a $1 billion business in a very, very short time frame of 15 years, and that too in a non-technology field, right? This is as simple brick and mortar stores as they come.
Yeah.
From the perspective of IPO, you know, like they timed this to absolute perfection, right? The sector has massive tailwinds. Pretty much half the world's population, or three-fourths the world's population, is working from home at any one point of time. Interest rates are so low that people need to park their capital somewhere. And this is something that we've talked about a number of times on the show. And where do you park it, right? Because cash is basically giving you zero. Bonds are zero, or for that matter, I think something like $17 trillion worth of bonds are giving negative yield. Equity, sure, it's for some people, it isn't for some people because of the daily volatility. And the other aspect where you can park your money is hard assets, which is property, something that a lot of Asian investors are very comfortable with. So when you buy this property and you want to like do it up, etc., where do you go to? You go to like one of these large stores, potentially like Mr. DIY, and try to like figure out how to, you know, upgrade your house, how to like set it up properly. So from that perspective, they have huge tailwinds. And in terms of them seeing these trends themselves, obviously, in terms of same store sales growth, etc., they have very, very aggressive plans. So from 2005 to 2020, they created 600 stores. In the span of the rest of 2020, 2021, they're looking to open up an extra 300 stores every year to get to something like 900 stores by the end of 2021, which is phenomenal growth, right? And to fund that growth, tapping onto the public markets makes a lot of sense. So from that perspective, great timing. We've seen the share prices of larger companies in the US, in Europe, et cetera, rally a lot on the back of this, like Home Depot, Lowe's, et cetera. So overall, it seems like, you know, the sector is doing really well. People are spending a lot of money in trying to make their homes more well-equipped. And the future seems relatively bright for this company.
Yeah, really interesting. Are you a DIY guy yourself?
I'm not, to be honest, but I do love to read about success stories, though, so I hope that helps.
Just had to find out. All right, let's look at Palantir. Wall Street seeing potential for break net profit growth. According to Morgan Stanley, it's initiated an overweight rating on Palantir's shares. Quite a mysterious firm. Tell us what you think.
So, you know, the big caveat to this, I would say, so Palantir went IPO through what is called a direct listing, which means the company itself is not looking to raise capital from external investors. Direct listing just gives an opportunity or an avenue for insiders to sell their shares and anyone like the public who wants to take part in the potential future growth of the company, they can buy these shares from these insiders who are selling it, be it institutional investors, the founders, co-founders, employees, etc., via the exchange. So it is publicly traded, but capital was not raised on the back of that. The big question mark, or the caveat I would like to add in, is this whole, you know, Morgan Stanley report of massive future growth for the company. I think it's really important for investors to know, or potential investors to know, that Morgan Stanley was one of the lead advisory banks for this direct listing. So I'd always take it with a little bit of a pinch of salt, you know, if they're trying to like highlight the future growth of the company. I mean, Chinese Wall is one thing which tries to split up research and investment banking operations. But anyways, that's a topic probably for another segment. But coming back to the company itself, you know, it's an extremely secretive, primarily government-serving business. And the biggest question mark, I feel, is it a lucrative software provider? Like, is it, you know, like a SaaS solution that have done, you know, so many software companies have IPO'd recently or have done so phenomenally well, like Zoom, etc., which is a plug-and-play type system, or even like Salesforce or something, which is more apt for like larger companies? Or is it a consulting business that can be quite lucrative, but you will never see the kind of exponential growth? So there's always a big question mark on, you know, which side of the table is Palantir kind of playing on. And in terms of pure numbers, you know, this is a company that has not turned profit in its basically 17 years of existence. Now, you know, obviously you have the likes of Tesla and Amazon and a couple of others that have become multi-centa-billionaire companies. But it's always a bit of a question mark to the business model as to why it's not been able to generate profit. Is it purely spending all its money on growth, or is there some other reason in terms of the business or industry that it's playing in? So that's something that, you know, investors should pay heed to. They are trying to change that around. They're coming up with this new thing called the Apollo delivery platform, which will enable more of like plug and play solutions where, you know, if you're dealing with the US government, sure, you're more than happy to have a very customized approach to analyzing the data that flows through the servers of, be it any department of the US government. But if you suddenly start going to the SME realm, or even like not such large companies, it stops becoming a profitable business if you spend that much time in customization. So apparently this Apollo platform will be able to streamline that entire effort. Obviously, it's a big question mark whether, you know, if someone actually uses this platform, do they get the full power and might of an extremely powerful platform that Palantir has created? But, you know, it really depends whether they'll be able to pull off this plug-and-play version of it, or do you need extensive consulting, you know, dollars to spend to ensure that you can truly utilize the power of the software?
So do you think because of the lumpy deals or limited visibility for future pipeline conversions, what we're seeing is Palantir trading at a discounted multiple relative to maybe its comparable peers?
So, you know, that's, again, a bit of a question mark, right? Like, are the multiples that its peers trading on, do they make sense or not? And I don't know whether trading at like 50 times expected revenue of 2021 is the right multiple or not, but you're absolutely spot on. In terms of relatively speaking, the multiples are a lot lower. And that's precisely because, you know, if you look at the number of users Palantir has, I think it was close to 120 odd in 2019. And only like about 25% of them, or like 20 customers were generating 2/3 of the revenue for the entire company, which kind of goes to show, just looking at the absolute headline numbers, in terms of what they've achieved in the past 15, 17 years, sure, I'm sure it's a fantastic product. And, you know, these large 20 players are truly utilizing the benefit of Palantir to the fullest extent. But does it become a truly scalable play for a investor to get involved in massive exponential growth? Or will this become more like the IBM of yesteryear, which is a very steady, or at least it was a very steady cash cow, because they were able to have that kind of moat created around itself, plug themselves into some of these larger players, and are able to monetize that year on year through consulting arrangement fees, other plugins to be added in, etc. So it could turn out to be a very good investment still. It just means that you won't see that exponential growth potentially, unless, of course, Apollo delivery platform picks up. And if you don't see that exponential growth in the future, should you be paying, forget even about like the relatively lower multiples to its peers, but how do you value this company? And then it turns back down, at least according to me, a more traditional value investor, I would say, is looking at the free cash flow, see how it's able to monetize these, be it 20, and see if it can become 50 customers in the future. And based on that, what should its valuation be right now? And purely based on that, maybe assigning a little bit of extra market cap to the new delivery platform that is being created, it seems like a quite overvalued company presently.
That's an excellent point. A bunch of excellent points there, particularly customer concentration, which would be a concern for me as an investor. That was wonderful. He's Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. And by the way, if you ever wrote a book called According to Me, anything, the world according to me, markets according to me, Arun, I'd buy it.
Thank you so much, Michelle. At least I have one buyer at work. So fantastic.
Hey. I know a couple of readers as well, and they'd be happy to come on. Listen, I don't know if you read this headline yesterday, but it really caused quite a buzz, quite a lot of buzz. So there was a web page for a digital currency exchange. It was briefly made public yesterday about DBS and its plans for a cryptocurrency exchange. So the bank has said it is still in the process of seeking regulatory approval. But the industry is talking about it and saying that if this is approved, this DBS digital exchange could be one of the world's first crypto exchanges backed by a traditional bank. So a bit of background there for the listener. There was a web page that was made public for a short while, taken down, and it said that this platform could list four top cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, Ether, Ripple, Bitcoin Cash, against multiple fiats, including the US dollar, Singapore dollar, Hong Kong dollar, and Japanese yen. All right, so your initial response to this, you know, that here we are, a big bank coming into a crypto exchange, not a crypto trading a marketplace, but a crypto exchange, right? So what were your initial thoughts?
I was shocked. I mean, this is very surprising where a large financial institution, be it releasing something on a website for just a couple of hours, as you mentioned, without getting the approval of MAS, the government, etc. It's quite surprising, because this is a hot potato right now, right? Where you have a number of regulators across the globe having very differing views, and you can't have one large player in that space go rogue in a way. So this must have been a big lapse in the compliance aspect of the compliance department to be able to publish this. That being said, though, and that cash page is still available on a number of blogs, etc., and I was able to read up on more details of it. So it's kind of interesting where what they're trying to come up with is the main reason for the existence of this is not for, you know, speculators in Bitcoin to be able to like pump and dump some cryptocurrency or whatnot. It's primarily for companies to raise capital via security tokens through the digitization of securities and assets. So, you know, let's try and break that down a little bit. First and foremost, the main function or the reason why investment banks exist, or they should exist, is not for random derivatives punting around, but it's to assist companies to raise capital. And going, you know, the way the world is going, digitization, etc., is, you know, fantastic, obviously, and giving an opportunity for companies to be able to raise capital via digitization of their assets or securities through this means, through a security token, is, I think, a very fantastic initiative in the long run, if financial institutions in general are able to control where that initial money is coming from, right? Because the biggest issue with Bitcoin and the whole anonymized nature of a cryptocurrency is it immediately leads to a lot of, you know, underworld kind of dealings of all sorts of, you know, unscrupulous activity.
Right.
So the fact that if they're able to truly legitimize this and are enabling investors to be able to invest into the securities and assets of companies looking to raise capital via these digitized beams, that's fantastic. And then in addition to that, they've created like this DBS digital custody for safekeeping of these digital assets. So, you know, of all these billionaires, quote unquote, that has been created by this Bitcoin boom, you see a number of really sad cases where investors have caught this wave, luckily, managed to make a lot of money. And then the next day they've realized that their entire account has vanished, which is really sad, right? So the ability for a bank to be able to create a true digital custodian for these assets, and I'm sure it will be extremely secure and safe because, you know, it's DBS at the end of the day. They have their brand reputation at stake. They have a phenomenal technology team. So from that aspect, I think this is really interesting in the long run. But I would like to say, you know, all these random blogs of Bitcoin and other
you're fading out, Arun, for some reason, and we don't want to miss a word that you're saying. Could you just repeat that last line?
Oh, sorry. So what I was saying was, you know, it's really interesting to see where all these random blogs that have like all these pump and dump cryptocurrency investors, they're claiming that, oh, this is DBS. This means that Bitcoin trading is legitimized, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's not the intention of this at all. Mm-hmm. Even though it was only for a couple of hours, even though they do not have government regulatory approval, et cetera, the reason for creation of this is for companies to be able to raise capital in a secure, digitized manner.
Okay, got it. Do you think, though, that what we're seeing, if it does pan out in the long run, or what we're seeing now, are you seeing more institutional financial services and crypto coming together?
So, you know, the world of financing, let's take a look at that first, right, is an absolute mess right now. If you look at the number of these oil traders that basically collateralized their fake assets, providing it to a number of banks, getting a line of credit, taking leverage punts on oil, going bankrupt after that, and then being on the hook for billions of dollars to these banks is an absolute mess. So from the perspective of, at least in the near future, I would say, having a really good solution to mitigate that aspect of fraud is great. The longer run question that you asked is a bit of a tricky one, right? Because I think from my personal perspective, speculation is not the main aim of why people should be in the capital market space at all.
Okay.
And I do have a sad fear that legitimizing the use of Bitcoin or Ether or something else to be able to purchase these security tokens could lead to a lot of ill-intentioned complications. That's the problem. So I hope it doesn't ever go down to that path, but I do truly appreciate the value of being able to invest into companies that have securitized some aspect of their assets or securities to be able for investors to invest in them through digital means. I think that's a very powerful effect through blockchain technology, through other digitized technologies that we are seeing in recent past. And I really hope that that does pick up because it'll be better for the world as in terms of pure efficiency of being able to invest capital in a much better manner.
A whole lot of important points there. We must note that what we've been talking about, those headlines about the so-called DBS digital exchange, DBS has said that its plans for a digital exchange are still a work in progress and have not received regulatory approvals. And until such time as approvals are in place, no further announcements will be made. We so appreciate you spending time with us, Arun. He's Chief Strategy Officer at Flow, Arun Pai. Have a great day, Arun, and thank you.
Thank you very much for having me as always, Michelle.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.